Welcome to On Publishing from the Binary Agency. This is Alex Field.
And this is Ingrid Beck. Every week, we talk to professionals from the world of publishing. Our goal is to educate, inspire, encourage, and inform.
Let's get started.
On today's episode of On Publishing, we talk with Jennifer Baker, production editor at Teachers College Press at Columbia University. Jennifer was nominated and actually won the 2019 Publishers Weekly Star Watch Superstar Award for her work championing diversity in publishing. She is a contributing editor to Electric Literature and is also the creator and host of the podcast Minorities in Publishing. Jennifer is the editor of Everyday People, The Color of Life, a short story anthology, which was published with Atria Books. And her short story, The Pursuit of Happiness, was nominated for a Pushcart Prize for 2017 by Newtown Literary Journal.
We had a great conversation with Jen. I loved hearing about her perspective on the role of a production editor, which is unique at every publishing company and at Teachers College Press, where she works. They do a lot. They're a big part of the process. And so it was good to hear her perspective on that, that role mm-hmm. within publishing in general. And also I found that, she is super involved in a lot of different things. She's writing, she's editing, she's contributing to other projects. And as a result, Jen has a fantastic perspective, on where publishing is going and some of the other things that are happening in, especially in New York publishing.
Yeah, she is super talented and we had a great conversation. You know, it ranged from talking about, you know, kind of nerding out over fonts, since she yeah. is one of the people that typesets books at Teachers College Press, talking about issues of diversity in publishing, which she is obviously really passionate about, and that's so needed right now.
Yeah, she also had a perspective on how to get into publishing. And she spoke to this very directly. If you're someone who is, you know, majoring in English or communications or whatever the thing might be, and you want to get into the publishing world, you want to be an editor or you want to be in marketing or sales in the publishing industry. She talked about how to get into this industry, how she got into it. She also talked about how a lot of that used to happen face to face. You know, some of the publishing mm-hmm. professionals would come to colleges and recruit. And she said that that's happening less and less, that it's more digital now, for better or for worse. And she had some thoughts on that.
So we hope you enjoy this conversation. Thanks for listening.
Before we get to our interview, take a moment and subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. We're available on Apple, Google, Anchor, Spotify, and elsewhere. And we're going to be posting weekly conversations with publishing professionals from all over the industry, from all categories and genres, and for people who are editors, publishers, marketers, publicists, authors, and writers, and a lot of others in between. So go ahead and subscribe to the podcast now. Also, if you have any questions you'd like us to discuss or any subjects, any people you want us to interview, shoot us a quick email with the word podcast in your subject line at info@thebinaryagency.com. And we'll try to address your topic or your question as soon as we can. Also, check out our website, thebinaryagency.com, for some free resources and articles. And a couple of ebooks as well are up there now. You can also download our free book proposal template to get you started building a proposal to send to either literary agents or publishers directly. One final note before we get started. Jen Baker changed jobs and companies since we spoke with her and recorded this conversation. She is now the managing editor at Random House Children's Books.
Today, we are joined by Jen Baker. Hello, Jen. I wondered if, first of all, you could tell us where you work and a little bit about your role there and what kinds of books you work on every day.
So the full-time job that pays the rent, because yes. also I like eating. So.
That is a good thing.
Yes.
It's a perk. Is Teachers College Press, which is part of Columbia University. So Columbia University has a multitude of schools, especially here uptown. I'm literally across the street from Columbia proper. And I'm a production editor, which is AKA a managing editor, that people may be more familiar with that term, which is the person who gets the manuscript once it's been acquired by the acquisitions editor. And we're the ones who get it copy edited and proofread and cleaned up and typeset. I do the typesetting. The other production editors, we actually typeset our books here. That may or may not be the case at every press imprint. And then we work with manufacturing. So sometimes those are two separate departments too, depending on, again, the publisher. For us, manufacturing is embedded within our position. So we talk to our vendors, we look at the advanced copies, we get those, we coordinate to get those to the authors. So it's a very hands-on job. We may not be acquiring the material, but we do become familiarized with the content of it. It's kind of very important for our jobs. And because this is a university press, we have a much smaller scale than, say, a Big Five publisher. Mm-hmm. So friends of mine who are production managing editors, they may be working on 100 books a year. Wow. And yeah. So, I mean, I don't know how hands-on that requires in certain aspects, right. But because we're doing maybe 60 and up a year, and there's four of us full-time in our department specifically, that means we're divvying it up and could be like 15, maybe 20, depending on the year. And sometimes we'll work with full service vendors, which means if we don't have the time to do it, that person will copy edit it, typeset, proofread, get the index and all that stuff for those books. And our books are pretty much for the professional market, which is also why I do a lot of my other side gigs and have been, because it allows me to be embedded in the trade atmosphere a lot more, because I enjoy academic publishing, but I also am not writing that stuff per se. So the other jobs I do really keep me in line and updated on what's going on in the trade sphere. And it is applicable. If you're well-read, you can do this similar job. If you're well-read or you're good at project management, this is a job that you can definitely apply in different areas.
Jen, take us into like the day-to-day life, or your sort of, you know, what does a day in the life of a production editor look like for you? I mean, obviously you've got to be, you know, super focused on grammar and copy editing and all of that kind of stuff, but it sounds like your role, there's a lot more to it. So what does a normal day look like for you?
Isn't that the funniest question? Do y'all get that a lot too? Like, what's a day? You're just like fire all the time. Fire. No. Yeah, it never, I mean, it seems like it would ideally be the same every day, but it also depends on your authors and the subject matter and, you know, who's on leave and all that stuff.
Sure.
But typically it is, I mean, the process goes, I get a turnover, which means that editorial turns over their manuscript to us formally. And they might leave us a little memo of, hey, these might be the problem areas. Here are missing elements, et cetera, et cetera. Here's the info for the authors so you can reach out to them. And again, when I edited my anthology, I never talked to my managing editor. I only talked with acquisitions editorial. They were the people shepherding everything. But for my job, I actually do talk to the authors. And I think, you know, they split that up very definitively at each stage of who talks to the authors. So at one point, an author can talk to everyone at the press, depending. Then from there, reviewing it, finding the right copy editor for the material. You know, I'm very obsessed with voice. So, you know, if there's an author who has kind of like a very amiable voice or kind of humorous, maybe don't put him with someone who's more serious on the copy editing end because they might be overly critical of their work. And then, you know, reviewing that stuff, sending it to the authors to make sure they're okay, making sure that the copy editors didn't say anything rude, which happens on occasion.
Yes, it does. You know,
it's like, what does this mean? This makes no sense. It's like, okay, let's soften that a little bit. And then get that back from the authors, make proofs of it. So that's when I start typesetting it and exporting it from Word to InDesign. Sometimes I'll do some image layout and then send it to proofreaders, indexers if needed, and the authors, and then shepherd that to the manufacturer printer to make sure everything gets good. And in between that, we've worked on the cover with the creative director or art director. and all that good stuff. So that is the streamlined, easy version if everything goes as proper.
Which it virtually never does.
Yeah. It's just like, this is what should be happening in 4 to 6 months.
Right. So have you worked at a trade publishing company before, or has your experience mainly been in the setting of a new university press?
I did internships with trade. And okay. Then a lot of my work for trade has been freelance based.
Yeah.
A lot of it. So that's been a sensitivity reader, a development editor, a copy editor.
An author.
Yeah. Writer. For them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Writing for trade outlets as well. So that's been the bulk of it the past like 5 years, or doing events at trade spaces, mm-hmm. Speaking on panels with other people or speaking on panels at companies. I'm supposedly doing a talk next month at New York Times. So we'll see how that goes.
Nice.
Awesome. Yeah.
But it's mainly been academic, because interestingly enough, and you may have seen this as well, and we'll see how it transpires as the years goes on. It's not to say that we haven't had losses. When the 2008 recession hit, we definitely got impacted all across mm-hmm. the board in publishing, trade, it doesn't matter where you were. You got hit hard that year to 2009, mm-hmm. 10, yep. Right?
That's right.
But we've been pretty consistent, because usually when recessions happen, people go to school mm-hmm. and then you see an influx.
Yeah.
Yeah. Usually. I don't know what's going to happen. God forbid we have a recession in 2021,
right.
But usually a lot of people are like, oh, well, let me refocus and recenter myself. Let me go back mm-hmm. to school. And then academic publishers, maybe not all of them, but you usually do see a little bump in terms of that. But that's changed a lot thanks to digital. So, yeah. And Amazon.
That's true. Yeah.
Oh, good old Amazon.
Yeah. Cannot mention them.
No, I know.
That's right. You can't help it. But Jen, I wonder if we could like rewind a little bit and look back at when you first decided you wanted to get into this industry in the first place, this crazy, wacky industry we call publishing. Was it something that you always wanted to do, or was this something that you sort of was an accident? You sort of happened into, or you realized you loved, later down the road?
For me, and this is something I've asked other podcast guests, has been usually you fall into it or you find out about it because, I guess subconsciously, publishing exists, right? If you love books, it gets made somehow. You just don't know. Kind of like hamburgers and hot dogs, right? Like, someone's making it.
Yes,
you don't
that's
know
right.
how, but you're like, okay, someone's making this and I'm enjoying it. So I went to high school. I'm born and raised in New York City, Queens specifically. So I went to high school in Queens, and you actually had a creative writing program in that high school. And then I majored in it in getting my bachelor's and my master's, my MFA. So I got all those kind of in sync, just like one after the other, after the other.
Nice.
And in the bachelor's, I went to the City College of New York, really not too far from where I am now. And they have a publishing certificate program, PCP, that still exists to this day. It was newer when I started, and that was like 97. And the organizers at the time, David Unger, who's still there, and Catherine McKinley, their goal was to get people of color into publishing roles. Mm-hmm. So I think it was them and the Denver Publishing Institute. Those were really like the early, early programs, especially awesome. Affiliated with academic institutions. And then Columbia and NYU and Pace and all these other places started doing that as well. But theirs was the only one centered on POC, people of color. And so I was there. Everyone kept asking me, as an English major, so you're going to teach, right, after you graduate? And I said, good God, no. No, thank you. I don't want to do that. And I met David Unger, and, he was kind of scouting people out. And he said, hey, have you ever thought of publishing? And I said, no, but that sounds amazing. And again, it was new-ish. So they had an established kind of layout, but it's broadened a lot since I was there 20 years ago, right? Almost 20 years ago. And that's basically how I got into it. And it was part of my bachelor's, so it was kind of considered a minor. You had to get 30 or 45 credits, and that's your minor, but the bulk of your credits is your major that you're getting towards it. So because I got a full ride to City College, which is why I went, I didn't pay extra for this program because it was lumped into my bachelor's degree.
That's awesome.
And I was able to take those. So I was very, very, very privileged and very lucky to not come out with any debt. Mm-hmm. I think this is a big thing to note as someone who pursued publishing.
Yes.
As someone who's born and raised in New York City. Mm-hmm. And who got a certificate program at a time in the early 2000s when, you know, we didn't have LinkedIn, we didn't have Media Bistro, you know, you were literally faxing things.
Right.
Wow.
You were emailing a certain people, you were getting phone calls a lot more, mailing things out. You know, that was the way it was done back then. So it led to less of an influx the way things are now. So I definitely think it was a bit easier. Because I had a lot more FaceTime with people than I ever had once digital media became proliferate. Once that happened, I would, you know, and I moved around a few times and probably will in the future, but I can't imagine having as much luck these days. It's not to say it's impossible, but this FaceTime is missing now. There's just something missing that was apparent in the early 2000s.
So what would you advise people to do if they really, you know, if they have a desire to get into publishing, how can they cultivate some face time, or what other approaches do you recommend they take to trying to get an entry point into this industry?
I would say the biggest thing, and I've kind of gone on Twitter and talked about this also, is asking very direct questions, because one of my bigger concerns, I won't say annoyances, these days is I've gotten busier as the time has gone on. Which I did not expect. You know, I was like, yeah, I never thought I would be as busy as I am now. And I'm not even at that point where it could be ridiculous, but it is, you know, I work a full-time job and I do all these other things. So when people come at me with emails that are just like, hey, I'd love to have a conversation about you, I cringe.
Yeah.
I mean,
wow.
I cringe because you're not telling me, A, I have a website. If you need to, if you were able to contact me, that means you found my website, which means you know what I do. Mm-hmm. I need to know what you want from me. Like, I am a busy person. New York is a busy city. What do you want from me? And maybe it's as simple as, I would love your take as a woman of color in publishing because I'm pursuing it. And what might I have to deal with as someone pursuing it right now? And I'm more than happy to talk to you about that. I've gotten several emails asking me to do free labor, you know, just saying, hey, would you like to talk to me about diversity in publishing? And I was just like, wow, that's bold. That's bold.
Yeah, not super attractive. Wow.
Well, it's like, hey, I talk about it all the freaking time. So why would you write it as, would you like to talk to me about it? And it's just like, I talked about it every month on my podcast. No, I don't want to talk about it anymore. It's just like those kind of assumptive methods of, it's friendly and it's trying not to be intrusive, but it's incredibly intrusive at the same time. So informational interviews, I've met so many people who are more than happy to do informational interviews if you come direct and have very specific questions. If you're just saying, hey, I'd love to have an informational interview, and then you call someone and they're, say, the graphic novel editor, and they're the only graphic novel editor for a whole publisher. So you automatically know they're getting bombarded with all this stuff. And who knows what kind of questions that are not meant to be inane, but are. And you just say, great, so can you tell me what publishing is like? That is not the best way to start off that question. You know, it's, hey, you do graphic novels. Are there certain things that I should be aware of? So someone who's really looking to move into graphic novels, I've worked with text only. How do you actually convert from going from an editorial approach from one form to another? That's such a specific question that someone can answer, and also shows an intense interest in doing better and learning more about that person's field, and a respect for them to be able to answer something that's specific. So I think if you could do informational interviews, ask for what you want. I mean, it's one thing if it's, can you get me a job, versus I feel like I have a distinctive resume. If there happen to be openings would it be possible for you to keep me in mind?
Right.
I would really appreciate it. It's all about wording. I don't want to tone police people, but we're in that day and age. But it's also about directness, because if someone just says, I really want this, but you're not really telling me what it is, or it's very broad or anything, or you're assuming I have all the time in the world because I seem pretty friendly. I mean, these are irritances to me. Hmm. Like, yeah. You know, I avoid my inbox for a reason.
Right.
Nowadays.
I just think that that point about respect, you know, and the expectation that the person you're approaching does have a lot going on and you're taking their time away from all of those passions and activities, that's really important.
Yeah. And you don't have to be in New York City to be in publishing. I always want to emphasize.
Right.
I mean, y'all can testify that it's,
we can.
You don't have to be in New York City. Yeah. That's a lot of people keep moving here. And I said, why do you keep moving here? Are you okay? And like, do you want to be here or do you just think you need to be here? Because those are two different things.
We're so connected digitally now. I mean, it feels like you can do this work from anywhere, which is super liberating. Although I will say there is something to, especially in the big publishers, being just down the street from the agents you work with or the authors you work with and going and getting a drink or having lunch or whatever. We work out of Colorado and we do a lot of book deals and it works just fine. So
I've lived here all my life and I'm sitting here like, no, you don't want to live here.
Love it.
Even though I don't think I could live in Colorado, because I'm just like, wait, are things open all the time there? Or some of the time? Like, can I walk to a bodega? Is that possible?
No.
No, okay. Just some of the time.
Can you tell us a little bit about the kind of extracurricular things you're involved in and the ways that your passion for literature, for writing, that you've made those a part of your life outside of your career? Because I think that is another way for people to be engaged with books and writing without it being their main full-time job.
Yeah. And that's what helps about, I mean, some people can turn it on and off. There are acquisitions editors who are writers who find it a hard time to write and be an acquisitions editor at the same time. That doesn't mean they have less love for either position. It just means it's a harder thing to juggle. Mm-hmm. And for me, I think my writing was always pretty paramount, but I also recognized that I don't think I could personally make a sustainable living off writing alone, because I'm a very contemplative writer. It takes me a while to get my ideas down and fleshed out. I don't like the pressure of writing for money. And I think it takes something away. Not to say that I don't think I should be compensated for writing. I absolutely do feel people's art should be compensated, but there's another pressure to it when you're doing it for money and you're doing it to sustain your day-to-day life. There's something that I think infiltrates that for me. For other people, not. You know, they're able to do it. They're able to pump out books annually and they're great and they're just what they want. I don't think I'm that person. So I need to be in another headspace.
Yeah.
So I was always applying to residencies, going to writers' conferences, which I also, and reading ridiculous amounts of books.
Yeah.
So I was always embedded in knowing more about what is going on in the current sphere of publishing. So who's out now, but let me try read, you know, stuff from the 50s and the 40s. I'm obsessed with the Harlem Renaissance. Mm-hmm. And let me keep up to date with that and also meet other writers, learn how to be a better critic. I didn't have a great experience in my MFA. That's another story. So I went to writers' conferences to meet other people from different areas and just get other perspectives, you know, joined writing groups here, came and went, formed more communities, went to readings. So I formed a community, at least in the artist space, right? And then the more I did advocacy around 2014, when We Need Diverse Books became a thing, and then I did my podcast several months later, that embedded me in another area of the industry, because then I was looking for guests for the podcast and I was talking at events and I was learning more about my privilege and I was hearing more from groups that I didn't have connections to previously, or didn't know I had connections to, or we didn't have those kinds of conversations. And so in that regard, it just broadened. It naturally broadened because of the work I was doing. So the writing group also, through direct action of the advocacy, broadens that, because I'm learning more about other people and I'm hopefully becoming a better editor and I'm becoming more vocal and doing all these other things so that you're meeting people. And the way that people look at me is in a very different context, depending on who I'm associating with. So one person might see me as an editor. One person might see me as a writer. One person might just see me as that diversity person. Mm-hmm. Or they might see me as all three at one time. But usually it's one of those three.
Yeah.
You know, other days it's just like, oh, you're the diversity person. It's just like, sure. Like, whatever.
Jen, when did you decide to start the podcast and what precipitated that? You know, that's obviously a big venture. We're engaged in that ourselves and it's a lot of work. So how did that start? What made that come about?
I had started working with We Need Diverse Books properly in August of 2014. I had seen what they were doing. So for people who may not be as familiar, We Need Diverse Books started as a hashtag because people were upset about the lack of visibility at, I forget if it was the first or second book con. So book con's adjacent to Book Expo. It's more for the people rather than the industry, right? So I forget if it was the first or second book con, but they were just saying, oh, well, there's really crap representation here. It's literally all white guys. And what was it?
Yeah.
Angry Cat or Mopey Cat? Like, I forget the cat.
Oh, gosh.
But there was like the cat. You remember the cat, right? Like,
oh,
there was
yeah.
this cat that always had like,
Grumpy Cat?
Maybe it was Grumpy yeah. Cat. That was a whole thing for a while.
Yeah.
And that's a whole other thing, because when they did photo ops for Grumpy Cat or whatever, that cat looked drugged. Okay. That cat was just like in a basket, blinking very slowly, had this mopey face. And it's like, that cat is drugged. That's this is wrong. Strange. Yeah, it was so messed up.
And yeah, it was like Minette Lady in there.
And you could take all these people were waiting in line to take a picture with the cat.
Oh, my. Huh.
That's an awkward thing. And yeah.
It is. And it sold how many calendars and memes that cat
my gosh.
That year?
Far too many.
Oh, my God. And now we can't even remember the name. we're like, Mopey Cat, Upset Cat. I don't remember what cat.
Somebody listening is like, it's Grumpy Cat, and you should know this.
Well, that just speaks to the nature of this industry sometimes that can be so disheartening.
Yeah. Yes, hilarious. I can see the cat's face right now.
Yeah, I was like, I can too.
Shrugged. So they started and they were just an online hashtag. So they were doing a week-long internet campaign on Facebook and Twitter just to say, use the hashtag We Need Diverse Books, da 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 da. So then the people who created the hashtag, which were all kidlit authors, middle grade, picture book, and young adult. And especially a lot of them were newer ones. So they were having their debuts in the past year or two. Mm-hmm. They decided to make it a nonprofit. And so it was very kind of piecemeal. So it was just like, we're a nonprofit now. Now we need to do all these things. And so they were collectively trying to bring people in. And one of the founders, Eileen Gregario, she had seen that I was big on Twitter. Just being big, meaning I was active. Mm-hmm. And said, would you like to be our social media person? And that's how I got embedded with Reading Diverse Books. And I was with them for 3 years.
Okay.
At the same time, a colleague of mine, who's also a woman of color, she was saying, you know what, we need to talk about the fact that we're talking about We Need Diverse Books, but we're not talking about the fact that we need diverse industry people. You know,
yeah.
She's like, you and I have been in this industry for a decade, for me, almost a decade for her. And we were often one of the few people of color we often saw outside of the mailroom and every company that we worked at. And he said, we should do a podcast. And it was a joke. We should do a podcast where we just talk to people because we were obsessed with Whole Foods at the time. And he was like, we should just talk because we're just talking like the Whole Foods cafeteria with other people who are marginalized and just talk, have good conversations. And then, so we started planning from June of that year on. And then we debuted the end of August. And here I am.
Wow.
She left soon after and I just kept it going.
How has the feedback been that you know, you've been doing it for a few years now? How has the feedback been? Obviously, Publishers Weekly paid attention and congratulations on getting the Star Award or whatever. But
thank you.
Yeah. How's the feedback been other than that? What are you hearing?
It depends, because initially I wasn't doing the social media and then I ended up doing all of it. And I think it wasn't even about initially getting any feedback. I mean, it was about being better. So it was like, hey, you got crap audio. He's like, oh, I got to fix that. But it was just kind of like, we want to have conversations with people. I want people to learn mm-hmm. what an agent does. I want people to learn about the Black marketing managers. I want you mm-hmm. to meet the people doing these imprints who have been doing this so far. You know, I want you to know who the authors are and all these people. And so for the first few years, it wasn't hard to get guests. It wasn't, right? Because people don't like to hear themselves talk. That yeah. was a big thing I found. Yeah. I don't know if you found that where people are like, nope.
Yes, for sure.
I don't want to talk about it, how much like, we hate our voices.
You'll get used to it, trust me. You'll get used to it. You'll learn to love it. Or just ignore it.
We hope so.
Yeah. So that was what they was like. People were very hesitant to hear their voice or be, you know, like people have a one-on-one conversation over drinks and be real. But not everyone wants to do it on a recorded show that's going to be live and posted somewhere. And that was totally understandable, especially marginalized people. You're asking people of color to do that, get on record and talk about the issues. Like,
right.
Yeah.
That's hard.
So it was hard at first, not because no one was rude. But you know, people were just like, I'm hesitant to talk about all those issues. And I found authors were way more vocal than authors were ready to be vocal. And it's interesting because like the alliances are different, right? Like I may or may not sell my book. So let me be honest. Whereas like someone who's working for a corporation, you have to be aware of what you're saying. And so it was just interesting over time. And now I'm inundated with author requests, which is funny. For the past 2 years, Minorities in Publishing has become the one-stop shopping. If you have a POC author, you want to place somewhere. It's like, is the author a person of color? Put them on the MIP podcast, which is great. But it also worries me about where else they're being pitched to.
Right.
Yeah.
Because if you're only thinking of me because they're POC, are you not thinking of them as being quote unquote mainstream?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's something that we've talked about when I've had conversations at previous roles and publishers about people of color and trying to make sure that you're not just, like you said, you're not just pigeonholing them as just talking about issues that are pertinent to people of color, that they should be tapped to write and talk about a variety of issues. That's really important.
And it's also, I mean, one issue becomes I can't read every book that I'm pitched. So I'm pitched every week. So I may not want to read that book. I can't read that book that fast and da 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 da. And also I don't just have POC, indigenous and POC people on. I have marginalized people on, and white people can be marginalized. So I've had marginalized white people on, you know, transgender, disabled, queer, etc. I think the only non-marginalized white person I had was Brendan Kiley, and that was him in conversation with Jason Reynolds about their book, and he talked about white privilege. But it's been great.
It's like
I don't even know, because I'm just like just putting out episodes all the time, and sometimes I hear people say, I bought this book because the guest was on your podcast, or I trust you, or I've been listening for a long time, you know, so it becomes piecemeal. It's like, I hear it on Twitter. I hear it via email. I get it via pitch because someone's listened and now they have a book out and they want to be on, or they want to have coffee and want to just do the pick my brain thing. Yeah. So it's varied over the past 5 years. So I just put them out, you know,
right.
Put an episode out. I got more episodes. Let's put them out. Let's make them good. Let's put them out.
Well, I have to say, like, it's super impressive, Jen, all the work that you're doing, in addition to being a full-time production editor, doing a ton of work there, and all your own personal writing and advocacy outside of that, then to put together a podcast and run that yourself and the Twitter page and all that kind of stuff. It's super impressive. And I also think these conversations, which may not be had very often in the halls of publishers, but need to be had so much. I just thank you for that work. I think it's really important, and I hope you continue it, because these are conversations we need to have in publishers, outside of publishers. We're a literary agency. We need to have them as well. And so thank you for that. I can't even imagine how you get it all done.
I don't. If I'm being honest, I don't. I used to put up episodes twice a month, and now it's once a month. So
I guess this applies to your production editor role. This applies to the other work you're doing. What are the challenges you see personally in your day job, in publishing in general? And I know that's a super broad question, but I ask it because one of the things we talk about all the time is, you know, how frustrating this industry can be. You know, we'll all have big dreams for a particular book or a particular author, and it can be deeply frustrating when something doesn't go the way we expect it to, or whatever the case may be. Publishing is hard, right? So what are the challenges you face and deal with every day?
This would probably be threefold. And this circles back to what I was saying about starting out 2003 and getting more face time. And this is not to say that this was not an issue back in 2003 or 1993 or 1983. And I blame digital media for a lot of things, but this overwhelming need for amassing so many books to dispense. I don't know what the numbers are. I remember someone put up figures on Twitter years ago that said 500,000 books in the US get published a day or so, or a year or something like that. You know what I mean? And you're just like, what?
Wow. Yeah.
How is this possible?
It's crazy.
How is it possible that many books get published and I probably heard about 1% of them? If that, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And I guarantee of that 1%, 99% were by Big Five. And that's how I was able to hear from them due to the access that they have monetarily, right?
Yeah.
I wish we could just shrink and do less books and be more focused. My attention span has absolutely been affected by social media. And so I have an inability, but I think focus is a bit of a deterrent for many of us, especially if you are used to being on social media or you're just used to having access to so many things. You know, I grew up pre this, you know, when I was in high school, even most of college, I didn't have all this.
Yeah.
So I can only imagine what it's like to grow up only with this all the time. We need more and more and more and more and more. And even our mandate at my university press is to do more. It's not to sell the books we have in a smarter way.
Yeah.
It's to just make more. Let's make more books. So we can sell more.
Wow.
Yeah. Let's not strategize. And I've heard about this in so many places, not every place, obviously, but so many places are just like, we need to pub more.
Yeah,
we need
to pub I've heard one. It too.
Well, what if we put focus on the 20 books we do? We need to publish 35 now. Because if like 18 of the 20 don't publish, at least we have more product to put out. And maybe from a business, I didn't get an MBA, I got an MFA, vastly different. But maybe from a business sense, you know, quantity will always trump quality in certain ways of sales. I don't know. It doesn't seem like that to me. But everything's a risk anyway in publishing. So how do you know? How do you know if you put $10,000 more into this book that'll actually recoup $35,000? You don't know. So what do you know? You know that putting out more product will more than likely always net you more money. Mm-hmm. But I wish that wasn't the default. I wish that wasn't part of the conversation all the time was we have to do more. Because that's also my mandate for myself. I have to do more. I have to do more for representation of publishing. I have to do more. And then I'm hearing it at work saying we have to do more as a company. And then I'm hearing it from the MTA, like we're doing more. You have to pay more if we're going to do more. And you know, it's the consistent rhetoric you're hearing every day. If you think about it, you're hearing it constantly. You're even if you go to McDonald's or someplace, buy more.
More, more,
why wouldn't you buy more? It's for less. Yep. Get more. Right. It's the American way. So I wish we would stop doing that.
That's interesting. It's no different in a university press than that tension of let's publish more books versus can we invest more in the fewer books that we're publishing? There's that tension between those two. And I've heard that in publishers, large, small, you know, some of the Big Five and others. It's fascinating. It's the same tension, same conversation.
Yeah. And then you have to be smart about it. I was talking to someone else at a small imprint at a Big Five, and they said, you know, I purposely go lower on advances for my books because my books will always earn out. You know, like that's strategy.
Yeah.
Right? It works for the author because then it's like you earned out. So you look good to us.
You get royalties faster.
Upfront, yeah. Exactly. Up front, it may feel like you're being shortchanged. Like, I should be getting more money now. Mm-hmm. But this person is strategizing so that A, they have a good record. B, their authors have a good record. C, they get more clout in the industry because they're like, hey, their sales are always tight. Their stuff always earns out. So I'm going to listen to you. I'm absolutely going to listen to you. And this person strategizes on that count. It's like, I'm trying to do this. This is my goal. And I don't know that everyone knows to do that. That takes, this person has a lot of experience, a lot of foresight. They're a brilliant person. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say other people aren't. It's just to say this person had a strategy, a very, 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 very clear strategy.
Yeah.
I don't hear that all the time.
Yeah. It takes a lot of guts to kind of go against the prevailing wisdom too, and have a different strategy maybe than other acquisitions editors or other publishers.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Or even publicists and marketers.
Sure. Yeah.
If you have a low or non-existent marketing budget, mm-hmm. what methods can you find to get advertisement or promotion for right. your authors? How do you get buy-in from your company beyond bookmarks?
Yeah. That like, is, yeah.
It's like,
yep.
You get flyers and postcards. Okay.
That's true. I mean, that's a real tension. If you pay, and this, and I've heard this from other acquisitions editors that we work with, if you pay less for a book, you know, you have less of a marketing budget. I mean, theoretically, exactly. And therefore you're doing bookmarks as opposed to advertisements or Facebook ads or whatever the other investments you might make. So there's real tension there. Although from the editor's standpoint, you know, to have less on, you know, less on the table in advance, it does mean you're going to earn back your money faster. So it's tricky, isn't it?
It really is. And this is what's been great about having these conversations on the podcast is in production, we're pretty isolated, right? You know, we don't really have to worry about the sales or the thing. We have to worry about making a good final product, but we don't have any say in what that product is. So I can get a messy, messy manuscript and there's but so much I can do. In right. my job. Mm. I can't rewrite the book. I don't have that type of time. You're not giving me a budget to hire a developmental editor to do that. Mm-hmm. So I'm working with what I can. And then maybe I have conversations with my colleagues because, you know, we're all pretty friendly. Mm-hmm. And then you're learning that we've been doing the same thing we've been doing for 20 years. This person's been in this position and that all they know is like the old school way. And then we have a person who's younger, who's trying to implement newer ways, but then the other people are hesitant to do that because mm-hmm. it costs money, because they don't understand. Yeah. So then you have, it becomes a battle of egos at one right. point, yes. which is not helpful at no. all. And I don't think people understand that. When you're an author, you're coming in and you're selling your book and you're happy and you don't know what those interpersonal relationships are. You don't know what those bureaucratic conversations are. I've been in right. those launch meetings. I've heard mm-hmm. the way publishers talk about authors at various publishers. I can only imagine how they talked about me when I edited my anthology because I was a hard ass. And I was just like, I know how publishing works. Don't talk down to me. Don't use that language with me. I know what that means. Mm-hmm. Aggressive means nothing.
Yeah, that's right. right. That's
like, we
right.
have an aggressive marketing campaign. No, yeah. you don't.
What does that mean? Yeah. We have a robust publicity campaign. What does that
that's
mean?
That's just a buzzword.
I hate those words. I yeah. hate those words. And I was like, don't talk to me. I know what that means. And then, you know, you become problematic because it's like, well, we're trying. And it's like, I understand you're trying. Be honest with me. I'm not telling you, I'm not asking you to tell me if you don't like so-and-so. Mm-hmm. I'm asking you to be honest.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're honest for various reasons, for good ones, for bad ones. But I wish we were a bit more honest with the authors so they could understand, and also a bit more contemplative and strategic in terms of what we're doing rather than the more, 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 because everyone's overworked. The publicists, yeah, yeah, the editors, God forbid people quit, God forbid someone's on maternity leave, God forbid yours is the book someone doesn't like.
Yeah, that's
right. In publicity and marketing, and that's your publicist, and they're not going to be enthusiastic about your book right. if they don't yeah, like it.
That's right.
And well, and it sort of these things.
You know, I think this do more philosophy, it creates so much angst for everybody because they aren't really mm-hmm. able to invest themselves in the work that they're doing. They're taking a template approach, as you said, with, you know, phrases like robust marketing plan or whatever. They're not really able to look at each book individually and figure out how do we strategically and creatively get this message out. And that over time leads to publishing people being jaded and cynical.
Yep. I've seen that too. you've probably heard it over the course of this conversation.
Yeah. Well, and we both,
you know,
yeah, we've been there. We spent almost 20 years in publishing ourselves. So,
but it seems like it's also different for y'all's because you do have to love, you know what I mean? Like, I don't have to love what I work on. I'm assigned it, but you do have to love what you're doing.
We do. There are certain things we do that's work every, you know, like every other job in publishing, but being on the agency side is a bit more, we have a bit more choice in some sense. And we get to work on things that we're passionate about, hopefully most of the time. But I love, Jen, that you kind of put your finger on a tension that, you know, I've seen over and over and over, and it's that what you just said, you know, people have done this way for 20 years. And it's so difficult to take on a new idea because of ego or whatever. But man, we need new ideas in publishing. It's so hard to get attention for anything these days, let alone a book. So how do we get those new ideas, and how do we put our egos aside and really try to publish well and market well and sell well and publicize and all these things and take on those new ideas and try new things?
Therapy.
Yeah,
that's right.
We all need therapy. Yes.
I agree with that 100%. Yes. Okay, so kind of a random question I'm going to throw at you, because in publishing, I don't know if this is just me or us, but it seems like we have strange fascinations sometimes. Like, for example, I love the texture of a book cover, like a really unique texture or something on a jacket that's really cool. And I've heard that you really like fonts. Maybe I heard that on your podcast, but what do you love about fonts? What other sorts of things do you love about books and publishing?
I'm with you also on the texture. So the anthology I worked on, the first run had like a matte texture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then I started seeing other copies that were not matte. They were much smoother, and then even the color was a little bit off. It didn't look horrible. It was just noticeable, but I think only noticeable to me because this is my job. So I said, what did they do? Yeah. Did they send this to?
Yes.
This isn't Matt. I don't understand. What is happening? Where are these from? And they said, oh, well, you know, the first run printed out or something, so they had to reprint. And I said, they did not go to the same printer. I don't appreciate this. I'm just like feeling my covers and I look like a weirdo. I'm like, this isn't the same.
I get it. I so get it.
But I just think font really matters. This is not a diss to the entirety of self-publishing, because I've seen it in indie presses too, or vanity presses, I should say. The misuse of fonts because it seems interesting rather than being readable. And that is so key. The one thing, this is what we learned as production editors, right? If you're really into that stuff, you want someone to forget about the font, technically. I mean, it's great if someone's like, oh, this is really nice. But then you want them to get lost in the book. You don't want them thinking about, you know, are the lines too close together? Is the kerning weird? And that, you know, the letters kind of smush, or, you know, the orphans and all that stuff. Like, our goal is to make it a smooth reading experience so that your eye doesn't get jarred. Mm-hmm. So if you get any kind of weird kind of fonts, and I don't know if you ever saw that Saturday Night Live skit with Ryan Gosling called Papyrus.
Yes, he loves Papyrus.
I feel like only publishing people understand that.
I love that skit.
Yeah, and you see how horrible Papyrus is.
Yeah, it's terrible.
And it's a horrible font. Like, it does make sense for a movie poster, I think.
Yeah.
In certain elements, but not the whole thing, you know? So if you had something... And I'll just say to people whoever's listening, you know, look up Papyrus and you'll see. You would not want to read a book that's Papyrus, because you will get distracted. And that doesn't mean there are certain elements, you know, kind of the little tail that you might see at the P and the T and things like that, that you're not going to notice. Maybe you will. Mm-hmm. But we want you to just have a smooth reading experience. And there are certain fonts that really contribute to that. And I believe it's serif fonts. I always get them mixed up. There's sans serif and there's serif. And sans serif is more like, one is like more like Arial. So they don't really have the tail.
Yeah, that's sans serif.
That
yep, that's right.
Like serif, Helvetica. And then the other ones are like Garamond, Baskerville, Times New Roman. Yes. You wouldn't see Times New Roman in a typeset book. So usually the sans serif is the display, which is, you know, your title, your all that stuff, your headers. And then the actual readable font is the serif one. And I've seen people flip it, which can work, but doesn't always work. And I've seen people be very cutesy with fonts so that it's kind of distracting. And then also one tends to work better on digital than on print.
Yeah.
So those are things you learn along the way. And sometimes people really try to flip it. And again, if you're of this age, maybe always seeing the Helvetica's and the Arial's doesn't bother you in print on online. Yeah. But I think for those of us who are older to remember pre-digital, you just want to lose yourself and you don't want to be squinting and you don't want to be your eyes to hurt. You just want your brain to just chill out and read a book.
That's right.
So that's why fonts are very important.
You really do love fonts. I love it. I love it.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's
everyone,
something
go watch that papyrus skin.
Yes.
So great.
Go watch it. No, I think that's something that people outside of publishing don't really understand how much intention goes into those choices, like even down to typesetting the book and how the font is spaced and arranged, which font is chosen. Like there's a whole art and science to that.
Yeah, and it needs to stand out, especially when you do covers.
Right.
When you do dark backgrounds, having white text pop out on that, it has to be really sharp and has to be really cunning, or else it's going to hurt your vision.
Right.
You know, like those contrasts are really important when it comes to cover design. And you don't have to worry about it because usually the sheets are like white or off-white or something like that, ivory. So you don't really have to worry about like black on ivory being problematic. But with covers especially, that's huge for readability.
Yeah, it's a really big deal. Well, Jen, I have one last question. Ingrid may have more, but one thing that we talk about all the time is how, you know, the special nature of books. So one book can actually really have a massive impact on someone's life, and it can sort of change everything. It can pivot your career or change your personal life or whatever it might be. I wonder if you could tell us about one book or multiple books that changed everything for you, that had a big impact on your life or shot you in a different direction in your career or whatever it might be. Is there one book that comes to mind that you would recommend to us and to our listeners?
I recommend anything by Zora Neale Hurston.
Yeah.
Quite frankly. Yeah.
I love her.
Their Eyes Were Watching God is not my favorite book of hers, funny enough. That's the one, that's her most read book. It's one of the most popular published books in the world, especially of the country. But it's interesting. I was like, it's not my fave.
What's your favorite?
I really like her memoir, Dust Tracks on the Road. I think that's so good. And I like her stories too. She has a new one coming out. These are quote unquote lost stories that Amistad is publishing that have been not accessible for years. And that's coming out January 2020.
Ooh, awesome.
How exciting.
The first week from Amistad books. So, she's a huge influence, especially I was introduced to her in high school. And I was introduced to her juxtaposed to Huck Finn.
Interesting.
Wow.
Yeah. And I realized I did not like Zora Neale Hurston when I first was introduced to her in high school. I was really into Steinbeck. I still do like Steinbeck's writing. I think he's very salt of the earth, as they say. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I read Huck Finn and I was reading all this horrible dialect for Jim and all that stuff. Like, ugh. And then I'm reading Zora Neale Hurston's and, you know, your mind is still being molded at that point. And I'm reading her and it's reminding me of that. So I automatically kind of associated her with this kind of minstrelsy wrongly when I first read her, because I wasn't exactly given the tools to decipher the difference. You know, it was like, you're reading Moby Dick, you're reading Steinbeck, you're reading Emily Dickinson, and then you get Huck Finn and Zora Neale Hurston. And you're like, what? This is weird. What Shakespeare, you know, it's like all these things are different.
Yeah.
But you're not necessarily, and this is not to critique my public school. I think they did a great job of like caring about us, but I don't think we were given the tools to really critically read these things and see why, like why I found them problematic at a teenage level. So then I reread Their Eyes Were Watching God in my bachelor's. I've read that book three times. I read high school, bachelor's, master's. And I finally liked it when I got to my master's, because by then I was seeing the difference of how I was reading it when I was initially introduced to it. And so then I was just like, let me read all her other stuff. So I read like Sarah Fonda Suwanee, I read Mules and Men, I read her short stories, I read her Dust Tracks on the Road, I have her letters, I read Barracoon, which they came out last year, all that stuff. It took a while for me to engage with it on a level of recognizing the work that she did on a sociological level and a respect level. Whereas what we were introduced to was minstrel. We're seeing ourselves as minstrels this whole time.
I need to go back and reread that.
See, yeah, I mean, you may react very, very differently. But if you look at current material, if you look at Colson Whitehead's, mind you, his is slavery. Zora Neale did not write slavery. You know, she wrote, you know, 1900s post-slavery material. So you want to be very, want to be conscious of that. But if you look at Underground Railroad, Colson Whitehead doesn't use dialect. He focuses on the cadence of sentences.
Interesting.
Yeah, there's no dialect at all, but it sounds, the Southernisms are there through the structure of the sentences.
I love it. That is fascinating too. I mean, it's, and the way you compared it to Huck Finn and some of the stuff in that novel, which we all read, I mean, it's just, there's major problems. So I could see why that would be problematic. And then going back, I haven't read her memoir. So I think that I would love to go pick that up at the store today. So I may have to go do that.
It's so good. So good. And there's not a lot of dialect in it. So if that's something people are struggling with at this time, she doesn't have a lot of it in that particular book. It's more in her fiction, but she is just definitely the master of dialect. She is the person I hold to that high standard. I mean, even other people in her time period were not as well versed in dialect as she was, because she was doing that study.
So I just have one more question. We talked a little bit about kind of the challenges of publishing, and you share some of your specific challenges, things you wrestle with. So how do you stay positive and excited about the work that you do?
That's a good question. I think it's just because of the people I have surrounded myself with are very conscious, aware people. And it has taken a lot of self-growth, continual self-growth, to become someone who goes from someone who is actively defensive to someone who's open to conversation. I don't like confrontation. I think people think I love confrontation. I don't like it. Yeah. It has to happen.
Yeah.
And so by those conversations and that recognition of what needs to happen and that you're not alone in this is really key for me. And that's part of why the podcast exists, is to let people know they're not alone. So those frustrations or those concerns or those struggles or those upbeat moments or those, you know, commentary, these are things people are all talking about. And I think once we're united in some level, it can help. Because I get frustrated all the time, just like we said, like 20 minutes ago. I'm frustrated when I hear that we're not focusing on a book that's a good book, that I think is a good book. I'm frustrated by that. But I can make it the best book possible. I can spend the money I'm getting on the books that I love. I think becoming a cheerleader rather than just a critique, there's just like something to that person, and I say this a lot, it's like curmudgeons, you know, the person who always complains but never uplifts.
Yes, you know, like, we all know those people.
You can do both. You can do both. Yeah. My family. I love them all, and they're just like, why are you always, just tell me something good. Just tell me something good. It's sunny out. Give me that.
Let's be grateful. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. You can do both. But I've seen this on Twitter too, is just like this person becomes known as the person who's always vocal, but not always as the person who's uplifting other people. Right. And I found like once I did more than the other, it became much easier to just feel good about the work. Because there's amazing work out there. I mean, the National Book Awards finalists were announced today. There's so many great books on that list.
Yeah.
Why are we like, I'm not saying don't vote, and I'm not saying don't complain about the state of the world. I'm saying go buy those books. Yeah. Do that too. Yeah. Vote, you know, buy the book on your Kindle, or better yet, buy an indie publisher or indie bookstore. read it online while you're voting. There you go.
Knock it all out. I love it.
Yeah. Literacy and voting rights. Yeah, I don't know.
That's wonderful. Like,
hey. Did your job.
That's right.
Jen, thank you so much for this conversation. Yeah, this has been really, really fun. For those of you listening, go check out Jen's podcast, Minorities in Publishing. Go listen to it. Support it. You have some episodes to catch up on. Once again, thank you, Jen, for your time. This has been really fun.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of On Publishing. If you loved what you heard, don't forget to subscribe and post a review.
This episode was edited by Joey Howell, and the music was provided by Not the King. And remember, until next time, one book can change everything.